There we go. Recording is in progress. And good morning, December 2nd, 2025. Welcome, everyone. We're going to sit for about 20 minutes, and then we'll find some kind of Dharma topic to reflect on. And now, of course, a couple more people are showing up that I need to admit into the Zoom world. All right, just settling into comfortable posture, upright if that is workable for you. The four postures are all, workable, useful. Sitting, standing, walking, lying down. And just gently closing the eyes or lowering your gaze. And attuning to your inner experience. Also aware of any outer experience, any sounds or sensations that are prominent. Just having a sense of settling. Coming into stillness. And feeling the breath moving in the body. How are things for you right now? What's your physical state, energetic state, emotional state, if there's anything obvious? We can give generic meditation instructions, but each of us is having our own experience. Maybe feeling calm and bright, maybe feeling distracted or anxious. Maybe be tired or over-energized. And yet the practice is the same, no matter the condition, practice of awareness. Can you feel what's going on? Can you sense it? You be aware of the thoughts that are passing through the mind. Is there an overall pleasant feeling or an overall unpleasant feeling or just a neutral one? And we let the attention gather around the breath. Simple movement, touch, breathing in, breathing out. The breath can act as a kind of calming device. And a very neutral kind of concentration object. Breath has a rhythm, rising and falling, in and out. Always changing. The mind tends to drift, spin out into stories and plans, memories, judgments, analyses. And so we keep bringing the attention back to the breath, training the mind to be present, to let go. Keeping the practice simple. Not looking for anything special, not judging what's arising. Okay. So, I promised I would put a link into the chat for information about the retreat in February 24th to March 1st. So it's 5 nights at Redwood Glen Retreat Center. Is it a retreat center? Sort of. It's in the Redwoods, kind of in the Santa Cruz Mountains. In any case, that link takes you to the page on my website, and it's just basically a flyer for the retreat. It gives you all the information and the pricing, and then the email address to contact Greg, who does the registration. We struggle with the finances of it because it gets more expensive every year, and we want to make it affordable. And we for several years, for many years actually, we had a benefactor who was giving us scholarship money, but we have not heard from him in some time. Perhaps we don't know why, but anyway, and so it's depending on what your finances are, it can be difficult. And we are, if anybody wants to donate scholarship money, that's greatly appreciated. And again, just you'd use the email address on there to let ask Greg where you could offer that. Because I know some people have a lot of money, and then some people don't have much at all, and it's called America. But anyway, how it is. Nonetheless, I hope to see some of you there. I presume some of you will be showing up. I was, attempting. I was sitting over in my. I have a where I meditate for my own practices over in the corner of my room, where I have a little altar with the Buddha and various objects and photos to inspire. And I was sitting there this morning, as I do just about every morning, and I was like, I got nothing. Kind of one of those states, as I said, kind of a lot going on around the household. But I have been, so as we were sitting this time, I recalled that I have been going through Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness, which is a highly recommended book. And I'm doing that, in another kind of teaching setting. I'm working with some other teachers that I'm working with and helping. And, if, first of all, just I recommend that book. That's the main title, Mindfulness, Joseph Goldstein. I don't know if I need to put that anywhere in the chat. I'm gonna let you handle it. Pretty easy to find. And if you don't know who Joseph is, he's, one of the first Americans to bring this practice back from Asia. And he was in the Peace Corps, I believe, in Thailand in the 60s, and got interested in Buddhism while there, and wound up then, after he left the Peace Corps, going to India for several years, and more or less living at the Burmese Vihara in Bodh Gaya, which was overseen by Anagarika Munindra. And Munindra had studied in Burma. He was an Indian Buddhist, of which there aren't that many. But he had studied for many years in Burma, and had c recently come back to India to guide and oversee the Vihara in Bodh Gaya. And Bodh Gaya, if you don't know, is the historic site where it said that the Buddha attained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, and there's still a tree there that people circumambulate. It's a huge sacred site. I imagine some of you have been there. I've never been to India or anywhere in Asia. My aversion to travel has kept me closer to home. In any case, Joseph practiced there for years and then came back to the US, I think, for good in 74. And right around that time, he had encountered Ram Dass, that summer of 1974, the Tibetan teacher Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche was having an event in Boulder, Colorado, a kind of gathering of the Buddhists, the ones that were around in those days. He knew Ram Dass, and Be Here Now had already been out, I think, for some time. Not sure when that came out, but anyway, Ram Dass recommended that Joseph be invited to this event, and it happened that Jack Kornfield had also been invited, and the two of them did not know each other, but they had sort of parallel lives. Jack had spent time in Thailand as well, and had wound up ordaining with Ajahn Chah, the great Thai forest master. And so but he had also studied in Burma as well, and so they both were very familiar with Vipassana, and that's what they both were kind of interested in teaching. And so when they met there, they started to teach together. This was the beginning of their connection, and the Western insight meditation movement started that summer at the Nalanda Institute. And in any case, Joseph, a couple years later, published a book called The Experience of Insight, which was based on talks he gave at a 30-day retreat. And so that was his first book in around 1977. And he's not a prolific author, but he's put out maybe a half a dozen books in the almost 50 years. And his book Mindfulness is kind of it feels like kind of the culmination. Like, it really brings together a lot of what he had been teaching over the years, but in a structure that's built around the Satipatthana Sutta. Oh, it looks like there's some people in the waiting room who just wanted to come for the talk. Okay, fine. Sorry. I'm not looking at my screen here very much. A lot of times when I'm talking, I like to look away from the screen. And so this book, Mindfulness, is based on the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the four foundations of mindfulness, the basis for the whole mindfulness movement and everything that's taught around that. And so one sort of oddity of the book, and I think it came out about, probably about 10 years ago. It seems like new to me, but I'm old, so 10 years is nothing. It's actually based on another book, which was by Bhikkhu Anālio, which is called Satipatthana, and I will put that, yes, and Sharon Salzberg. But Jack and Joseph met before they invited Sharon to teach with them. Okay, Bhikkhu Anālio, his book is called Satipatthana. And Satipatthana is just the Pali for foundations of mindfulness, or establishments of mindfulness. There's various different translations of the term. And I know I'm making this sort of a history talk today, but sometimes I think it's useful. We'll get around to some of the more Dharma aspects. But Anália's book came out, I think, around 2004. And it was just as the mindfulness movement was kind of taking over the secular mindfulness movement. And I think there was a feeling in the more Buddhist side of things. There was some concern that, Buddhism was going to get diluted by the mindfulness movement, and that it was important to really hold on to, and keep working at the deeper Dharma t teachings. And so it seemed like Anália's book was kind of this marker, kind of saying, we're not going to just commercialize this thing. We're in fact going to investigate it even more deeply. And so, the Satipatthana book is quite a remarkable piece or publication. Very deeply researched, with references to all kinds of other Buddhist teachings besides that one sutta, which is not a huge document. The Satipatthana Sutta is a relatively short piece of, I'll say writing, but it's not actually written originally. So when Joseph encountered Anália in his writing, he was like, "Oh, I really want to do this too." And he wound up giving something like 52 or 53 talks based on Anália's book. And then those were transcribed and edited, and he turned it into this book. So it's quite what's particularly becomes evident in Joseph's book is how much is contained within this one sutta. And if you ever want to look up that sutta, it is in the Majjhima Nikaya, which is the middle length discourses. Maybe I'll just put that in English. I can almost see middle length discourses. Thank you for correcting my spelling, Zoom. Or did it? I can't see. Really terrible. Discourses. And it's number 10. If you're looking for it. And so the discourse, obviously I can't go into a whole lot of detail about it because, it takes 300 page books to even capture one version of it. But a few things that I find striking about the sutta. First of all, it's one of those things where, when you start to meditate and you're trying to figure out how to do this and you're trying to kind of get comfortable with it, you can kind of get to a point. Like at first, you're just sort of doing what the teacher says. Okay, my breath, my mind. Okay, come back to the breath. But at a certain point, you start to get curious, like, what exactly am I supposed to be doing? And then, what did the Buddha actually say I should be doing? Because my mind is everything is so amorphous and chaotic and hard to pin down. So you go to the sutta thinking, okay, great, it's going to explain it all. And then you start reading the sutta, and you're like, what? What is he saying? And it can get even at first, particularly even more confusing. So it helps when people like Joseph and Anália kind of take it apart for us. But first of all, the structure of it is quite simple, right? There's four, what we call them foundations or areas of experience that the Buddha is pointing to that he says we should pay attention to. So four areas of experience. So that sounds okay. Sounds manageable. The first one is body, which is like, okay, that's really easy. That's what mindfulness of breathing is, mindful walking, mindful eating. Great. All of that makes sense. Listening. And the second one is translated as feeling. And so the first thing you think is, oh, great, this is going to be about like emotions and how to be mindful of emotions. And no, it's not. So, because you're reading, like, what are we doing here? And it's what's called feeling tone, often, and the translation of this word Vedana, which those of you, many of you have been hanging out with me for a while now, so you're pretty familiar with this term. That's not a not a there's no English translation of the word, because I would say there's no kind of idea that this thing they're calling Vedana, we don't even have the concept of it. So we have to, okay, what it's the pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral quality of every sense experience, including the sixth sense, the mind. And even that's like, okay, so when I hear something, there's a pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral quality to it. When I taste something, same. When I smell something, when I see something, when I think something, when I feel something, it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And it just seems like, yeah, so what? Right? Like, okay, like, what's the next one? Sort of. But it turns out it's really, Vedana is kind of this key connective aspect of experience, because it's the thing that triggers everything. And that, I think maybe that, just keeping it as simple as I can, that's kind of why it's important to notice whether things are pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, because that feeling triggers things. And here we are, a collection of people who are, ostensibly in recovery or wanting to be in recovery. And we know something about getting triggered, whether it's being triggered in behavior or being triggered emotionally. It means we're set off and we start to behave in ways we don't want to, or feel in ways we don't want to, or act in or feel things that are not helpful or that are harmful. And we get triggered into anger. We get triggered into addictive behavior, into craving. We get triggered into, sadness and regret and guilt. And so, wow, all of a sudden, like, feeling tone becomes much more interesting. It's like, oh, this is like the thing. And yet, it doesn't have any. It's really hard to point to because we've never noticed it before. So the way I like to talk about this is that feeling tone gets kind of buried underneath the more complex elements of experience. So, for instance, and this is my ongoing example because it's nice to keep it simple, I like potatoes au gratin and I like chocolate. They are totally different as we experience them. We don't think of them as being similar in any way. Their flavor is totally different, but the liking part is the same. And so if I take a bite of either of those, my immediate The thing that I'm immediately aware of is not that I like it. It's the flavor itself. And so it's the flavor which is will connect in terms of mindfulness. That's a body aspect, right? Mindfulness of the body, flavor is part of mindfulness of the body. So that tends to overwhelm or blind us to the just pleasantness of it. So that's, my way of characterizing what makes it difficult to pull it out. But just knowing that this teaching is there, we can then still kind of pull back and go, oh, what's going on right now? It seems like where this gets complicated is around emotions, right? What's going on right now is I'm really angry. But if I remember, oh, you know what? That got triggered by something unpleasant. Then the anger might still be there, but I'm bringing forward into my awareness that unpleasantness. And so a lot of, for me, a lot of awareness of Vedana is only in retrospect. I realize, oh, I got triggered. Oh, let me turn away from the flavor, the emotional flavor, let's say, and turn toward and see, oh, that was just unpleasant. And that's okay. And this is one of the things about Vedana. It's like realizing when we see things in these simple terms, it's just pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. It's not so overwhelming. The complex flavor of emotions can be overwhelming. Whereas when we just go, oh, it's just unpleasant. Let me breathe with the unpleasant. That's okay. I can be with that. So let me go through the four foundations since that's sort of what I seem to be talking about. So we become aware of this body, feeling, tone. Third foundation is mind or citta, but it's mind's mental states of mind. And this is another thing that shows up as a group of lists in the sutta. But again, not quite how we think of. I think in our culture, at least how I think of my mind, I think of my mind as thoughts, but the sutta is not really pointing to thoughts. It's pointing to things like, well, desire and aversion or concentration or distraction. And so it just the idea of a mental state is what we're supposed to be aware of, which again, a lot of what we're doing, I feel, in mindfulness is kind of stepping back rather than being caught up in the content of our experience, either the thoughts themselves or even the emotions themselves. It's what's the nature of it? Oh, that's an agitated mind. Oh, that's a calm mind. That's a joyful mind. That's a regretful mind. But it's just seeing it's a mind state rather than being really engaged in the content, much as with the feeling tone, we're not sort of getting that engaged with the flavor of the experience, but just with the pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral quality of it. So the mind state is very similar in that regard. Oh, what is my mind state? So it's this kind of objectivity that we're working toward, I think, with mindfulness. The fourth foundation is, again, difficult exactly to define. In the suttas, it just says dhammas, which is Pali for dharmas. And then the Buddha just says, pay attention to the five hindrances, the five aggregates, the six sense bases, the Four Noble Truths, or the Seven Factors of Awakening, the Four Noble Truths. I think those are the five. There might be some others in there. But it's here again, it's like we're being asked to look at our experience. And the way I like to characterize this is look at our experience through the lens of Dharma rather than through the lens of self. Rather than saying, oh, what's happening to me? It's just what's happening. No. Oh, there is aversion. Oh, there is perception. Oh, there is, concentration. There is energy. There is suffering. There is letting go. Just the, so we start to see that this quality of mindfulness has this objective nature to investigate what is happening, and trying to do that from this viewpoint that it's not about me, and not identifying, not getting caught up in identifying with the experiences. So one of the things that has always struck me about the sutta as well is some of the things that are left out, particularly emotions in the typical, again, Western psychological way of thinking about emotions. I mean, the Buddha certainly spends time talking about, I think the two main emotions that I see being talked about in the suttas in general, not particularly in this sutta though, are anger and grief. I'm not sure if those are meant to stand for other things, or if the Buddha just doesn't really want to talk about or think about, like, the things like anxiety or depression, or the sort of things that Westerners are treated for these days. But it's worth noting in any case that emotions as we think of them, and I'm not sure that we have a very, in our culture, that we have a very clear way of thinking about emotions or defining them. But they're certainly not addressed in the way that, I was sort of acculturated to understand emotions, which again I think points to this overarching theme that because emotions are so personal, that the Buddha's really not that interested in the personal per se, that he's more interested in the Dharma. How does this fit into the a Dharmic context? So I'll just wrap up by saying that, certainly I recommend for anybody to read Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness. Anaglio's book is much more of a scholarly and difficult read, and when I've gotten a lot of feedback that people had trouble with it. So unless you're really a long-time practitioner and done a lot of study, you might be sort of just get bogged down in it. But I think, reading Joseph's book and looking at the sutta and getting some idea of it is a great way to go deeper into a Dharma practice with a, very skilled and compassionate and wise guide, that being Joseph Goldstein. So I hope that's of some value to people today. I appreciate you showing up, and I will open it up, see if there's any comments or questions. I will also give you, because it's part of my job, here, this is the page on my website that if you want to offer some dana to me, this page will tell you how to do that, and also the tradition a bit. Hello, Vicky.
Hello, hello. Great stuff. Vedana is, the super simple. And so it comes so immediately with experience, right? There's like something happens and there's like, I don't know if there's any, there must be a little bit of room, right, between the thing that happens and the Vedana that goes along with it. And then that it strikes me that the Vedana is parallel to dukkha, right? That there's that there's, for the pleasant, there's, the clinging, the desire, the crave, all the stuff that goes along with pleasant. And then with unpleasant, it's aversion. So that there's instant dukkha built into Vedana. Is that true or?
Well, it's, in the teaching on dependent origination, the formula says that Vedana is followed by tanha, craving. So feeling tone triggers craving, and craving triggers clinging. And so this is the one place in the process of dependent origination in which we can step out if we see and just see, oh, this is just unpleasant. I don't have to go into aversion, or this is just pleasant. I don't have to go into. So it doesn't. It's not automatic. In fact, it's what the argument could be made, and I think it's a pretty good argument that the reason the Buddha made Vedana one of the four foundations of mindfulness, meaning that like 25% of your attention should be on it, is that if you can see it, then you can interrupt the arising of suffering.
And incline the mind in a different direction. Yeah.
Right.
So early intervention.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, good.
Exactly.
Great,
Call
great.
your sponsor.
And this progression. Yeah. Okay, good. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. Forrest.
Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
Yeah, I really like this. It's been a common theme in some of your last Dharma talks, and something in my mindfulness I've been really sitting with on the feeling tone. I like the ice cream. I think though when I have my bowl of ice cream at night, and paying attention just to the feeling around it, not the flavor. But anyhow, I find when I sit with certain things, there's this paradoxical things where I feel both simultaneously positive, an attraction as well as an aversion. And I mean, I can think back to my days of drinking and drugging, where I did have a kind of paradoxical relationship with alcohol and other molecules. Currently, I'm redoing the steps. This time around, I'm doing the ACA version of the steps. So I'm midway through a very deep four step. And yeah, it's a very paradoxical relationship with it, where there's a part of me desires to do this deep work, but at the same time, an aversion to revisiting these various and often painful childhood memories. And yeah, I find that's a, and holding space for both at the same time. I'm just wondering, does that come up? And I haven't ever studied the sutra directly.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, the Buddha takes everything apart into pieces, but they don't exist in pieces. They're really only experienced as this more, a bunch of things happening at once. So, yeah, I mean, that's, I think that's, I'm not, there's nothing in the sutras particularly about that sort of contradictory experience or mixed experience, but of course it's the lived experience, and what it's the complexity of being a human being that we can want something at the same time we don't want it, or we know we shouldn't do it. So this is where mindfulness is so important, because the mindfulness is what gives you the ability to make a choice. To choose to continue on in the wholesome direction, to not to see, oh, I'm still pulled, but that's not really who I want to be. And that's why we need to be awake. If we're not awake, we're just pulled, and we just follow the pull. And yeah, it's hard. I mean, it just is, because we're so deeply conditioned. And this is, again, like this idea of against the stream. It's a going against your conditioning, the habits. And And then waking up is like coming out of that conditioning and realizing, oh, that's just a habit. That's just something that's ingrained in me that's not good, Oh, that's much where we have to let go. But nobody said it was easy. Thanks for that. Abigail.
My question is,
Yes.
when you tell the story of your teachers telling you to feel your feelings,
Yeah,
are you
true.
talking about Vedana?
That's a good question that I don't have the answer for. I just don't know. I think they were trying. I don't know. I just it's yeah.
I've recently been aware of how disconnected I am from my feelings. And so I've been sort of putting that into my meditation. And it's confusing.
Yeah. So I guess, I mean, giving me 20 seconds to think about it, and you saying that, trying to be aware of your feelings, it's feelings, as we use that term in English. I mean, obviously, it can refer just to feelings in the body, like you feel sick, but generally, when we're talking about feelings in kind of the more general emotional mood version, it includes body, feeling tone, and mental state. So it's that. So I think when we say be aware of what you're feeling, yes, part of that is the Vedanic quality, the feeling tone. But part of it is the flavor of it, right? The body and mind state of it. And it's the point of being aware of Vedana is to see that it's the Vedana, the quality of being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, that's gonna kind of give force to the emotion and have it create. Start replicating itself, right? Start thinking on itself and processing, and which then turns into a more like feeding it, right? Rather than feeling it. In other words, we go from thinking about it, we go from feeling it to thinking about it. And when we start thinking about it, then it becomes it. That's what makes it kind of explode. And so when we come back to like, oh, this is just unpleasant, then we're taking the most simple aspect of the feeling. There are other aspects to the feeling, but the Vedana is the most simple, because there's just three types of it. And if I could just hang with that, then the other things kind of fade a little bit. And I sit with that and I allow that, right? And that's where the mindfulness of just letting it come through and being trained as we are in our practice to just sit with an experience without doing anything about it. That's where that comes in. And we're able to then interrupt the reproductive aspect of feelings in that bigger sense.
How could chocolate ice cream be neutral?
I mean, it only if you just didn't care about. I bet there's some people for whom that's like, yeah, but generally, fat and sugar are, found, people find them to be pleasant, so. But that's more of a theoretical question, Abigail.
Thank you. Thank you, Finn.
Yes. Okay, thank you. Mal, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for this talk. And Vedana, it's reminding me, and the ice cream. So I listened to the, this book. These series of books are on Audible, and he does. He there's entire. It's like a several hour Audible book devoted to Vedana. And I remember. Maybe like 2 years ago, I was not healed with my eating issues. I had been sober, but I still had some eating issues and a lot of anxiety around eating and the belief that if I have nachos, I won't be able to stop. And then it would give me shame for eating the nachos. And then the shame would cause me to eat more nachos. And it was a big mess. So I remember going to the Mexican restaurant and paying attention to the Vedana when I would eat the nachos. And that was how the habit started to unwind itself, was just being mindful of the Vedana. And then that allowed me to do the deeper work with the eating. It was just kind of being mindful of the Vedana, and the habit just kind of took care of itself that way. I had to go to a lot of therapy, of course, as well.
Well, goes without saying.
But watching the Vedana was also just being mindful of it. It was really, really useful, and it's reminding me of how useful it can be to just be mindful of Vedana in so many situations. So thank you.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you for that endorsement of mindfulness. Thanks, Mel. All right, we're well over the traditional 11 a.m. Pacific ending. However, Paolo has the virtual hand up, so let him be the final comment.
Good morning, Kevin. I'll be real quick. It's just remarkable to me, and it's great when I hear other people reflect it, because I beat myself up all the time after, like, let's say emotions. I'm going to pay attention to emotions now, and doing so, and right, like I would never take two lessons in tennis and then start beating myself up for not having mastered it. So,
Right.
yeah, thanks, Kevin.
Yeah, thank you, Paolo. Yes. Yeah, and I've been reading also been reading the book Altered Traits by Dan Goleman and Richard Davidson, where they study the brains of like, Tibetan monks who have been meditating like in caves for decades and 70,000 hours of meditation or whatever, and like, oh, okay, yeah, I see. So that's what it takes. Well, lovely to see everyone. I will be back here next Tuesday. I don't think I have anything else scheduled. But I did send out an email to my mailing list, if you're on that, about the retreat and about other things. In December, I'll be at Spirit Rock on December 21st for the annual Keep Coming Back Day Long. So I hope people will make it for that. Otherwise, I'll see you next week. Peace.
Thank you, Kevin. Thanks for
Okay.
reaching out for the food thing too. That's a good thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think
Good.
it's exciting for the retreat to get some you talk about
Oh,
that.
right. Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, I tried.
Yeah, that sounds
Well,
good.
yeah. Hopefully
Thank
it's
you.
better. Yeah, thanks. Take care.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.